What does it mean for God to be God-forsaken? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host from the Walla Walla University School of Theology. With me again as conversation partners are Larry Baburka and Dave Thomas, my colleagues. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Alden.
Atonement at the Cross. This week we're going to focus in on the events of the cross itself, beginning in the garden. And I don't know, this touches very close to each one of our hearts. We'll just go through the events and see how far we can get in the next few moments here. Let's start with the path to Gethsemane. Jesus knows where he's going. He leaves the upper room and is surrounded by half-baked friends and his enemies on the way. What does that mean for Jesus at the personal level?
You know, what strikes me about that story is two things. First of all, it was a descent from Jerusalem down, and then, you know, that becomes a metaphor in some ways that you could play with.
You go down into the valley before you go up.
Yeah, down into the valley, into the darkness. But the other is the vast distinction between the mindset of Jesus as they went down there and that of the disciples. The disciples hadn't a clue, somehow, of the depths of sorrow and meditation that Jesus was descending into. They were still just carrying on their usual flippant business. And, you know, it's I find myself hoping in life I don't have that kind of experience where I miss out entirely on what is happening in either somebody else's life or in the experience of God.
For Jesus to see so clearly what lay ahead of him, and it was quite clear through his ministry that you get through the Gospels, I'm going to Jerusalem to die, and the disciples would have none of that.
Yeah.
But to head to that garden, sensing what lay ahead of him, must have been an incredible experience.
Well, he's already feeling something pretty incredible if he is, as he approaches the garden, falls to the ground as one dying.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, the weight, the burden that weighs him down, drives him into the ground, you know, is crushing out his life, is mind-boggling.
Now, when we use the language, as we typically do in Christian theology, that there is a separation between the Father and the Son, I think we need to recognize that this is God is separating himself from God. This is not a hierarchy. Jesus has emptied himself, Philippians 2, and we've talked about this before. So he relates to this whole situation as a human being. But what was such a powerful temptation for him was that he had immediate, instantaneous access to divinity from within himself, if he would.
By which he could escape.
By which he could escape. I tell my students, if you get a Porsche on the freeway and say you can't go any faster than 45 miles an hour, that's temptation. If you take a mountain bike and say you can't go any faster than 45 miles an hour up the mountain, that's not a temptation, because that's not possible. So none of us know the power of that temptation which Jesus had.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get to the garden, that if possible, let this cup pass from me.
And I have to tell you, as I see this list here, I realize that of all the events of the crucifixion, this is the one that has absorbed me the most. In fact, the other ones I may not have much to say about, but this one fascinates me.
Jesus' prayer that the cup be taken away.
Yeah. And it's precisely because, you know, there's several things in that story that intrigue me. Human failure is one, and I don't spend a lot of time on that because there's plenty of examples of that. But the other one is the wrestling with God until God wins, is the way I like to phrase that.
That's a great line.
You know, the battle of wills in one sense, but in another sense it's not a battle of wills because Jesus is complicit with this and in agreement right from the beginning. So, you know, I don't think we can pit the Father and the Son against each other here. It's just the dynamics of Christ's humanity and the Father's divinity are at odds. And you know, the prayer you mentioned there is a very interesting one, because the first two prayers Jesus prayed were the same, but the third one has a note of resignation that the previous two do not have. The previous two are hoping, is there some other way, because of the sense of dread. And, you know, I'm intrigued by the struggle that unfolds by prayer. And, you know, that really opened my eyes to the significance of prayer. We see prayer in many ways, one of them a gimme list, a psychological escape valve, you know. But for Jesus, and I think for us, the profoundest dimension of prayer is one of struggle. It's a crucible in which the will of God and the will of man, or the will of man is ground up, that it can be put into solution with the will of God. And, you know, that to me is the quintessential story of that experience in the Bible. Then, of course, Jacob in his wrestling with God is a precursor to this, but I've thought many times about that experience, the great struggle, which, by the way, when it is resolved, brings a sense of relief to Jesus. He knows now that there's no longer a struggle to get out of this. There is the empowerment to go through it.
Yes. See? Well, Jesus' prayer life, you mentioned that, Dave. This has always intrigued me, because Jesus tells us very little about the mechanics of his prayer life.
Yeah.
I've always been struck by that passage in the first chapter of Mark. Jesus rose up a long time before day, while it was still dark, went out and prayed. Doesn't tell us a squeak about what he says. No. When the disciples ask him, he gives them a 39-word prayer.
Yeah.
But he prayed hour after hour after hour. And if the perfect man did that.
You know, I know prayer is a difficult subject, really. I just wish that when we prayed, we could hear more than just some impression of the human mind. It would be so wonderful. But anyway.
Okay. Let's go on to the next step. And let's go to the cross. The deep darkness where he's senses that he's handed over to the forces of evil.
Well, I mean, that's a dark hour.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by his fortitude in that time, though.
Yeah.
That even when people come and try and numb his mind with those herbs and whatever they were, he refuses, because I think he wants to make sure that his passage through this is with as clear a mind as possible. That's how I read those passages.
Well, Satan and his angels are there at the cross. This is their final shot at getting him to prove his identity by an act in which he uses his divinity to leave that cross. On the one hand, you see his resolve to see the salvation or the healing of the human race through to its conclusion. And you wonder if Satan even has a chance. I mean, it's a terrible kind of experience to be crucified, to die naked. You can imagine the sort of things that they're hurling at him in their attempt to goad him into some sort of act, the innocent one who shouldn't be there, but for them to do that sort of thing, trying to goad him into some sort of use of his divinity.
Well, the three final items on my list here, and we could talk about all seven of his expressions on the cross, but I think the three really pointed ones is the cry of God-forsakenness, my God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?
You know, that must be the most desperate cry that ever came from a human being. Because I think more than anybody else, he would have understood that. And I can't say that I've ever been abandoned or felt completely forsaken. I don't know if either one of you have.
Well, I take great courage in the fact that that was originally a real prayer of a real psalmist in the Old Testament, Psalm 22. And I find my students...
That's true, it is.
I find my students reluctant to pray that prayer. See? Now, I see that as the first step back towards faith. Because if you can shake your fist in God's face, at least you know he's there. See?
Yeah, and that's, I remember hearing somebody make that point here. They said, my God, why have you forsaken me? But at least, or still, my God.
My God. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's and that's the power of the laments in the Old Testament as well, because at least you have not given up. You've just not sneaked away into the dark. You're still crying with him.
So. Yeah.
And
I think one of the darkest hours of my life experience was being on the trail 18 hours of the Munched Ankle going up over Vogelsang Pass, and at 10 o'clock at night, hungry, exhausted, and in terrible pain, really complaining vigorously to my guardian angel about my distress and wanting to die, literally. I would have
too much pain.
I would have preferred death at that moment to living. But I find solace in Hebrews 4, where I'm encouraged to approach him when I'm in times like that, because he's been there. And he knows what I've experienced.
Yeah.
And of course, you have the prayers of Jesus, and one can be a bit shy because we're not God. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why you have other prayers in Scripture, because there are one place where Jesus, there's one aspect that Jesus never identifies with us or we with him, and that's the result of broken promises. That is the hardest thing for us to put. Jesus never had to experience that, see?
Yeah.
And we do. That's why you need people like Peter and John and David and all these other guys, because that way you can really find additional one. The last two cries, the cry of submission, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. And then the very last one, it is finished.
That prayer, into your hands, this is the God who's not there.
Oh, wow.
He's putting his life, his whole, whatever he's done, he's putting in his hands, trusting him to deal fairly, justly with his life. He says, whatever, I feel like condemned, the worst of sinners, this death is deserved, whatever. I mean, and yet I trust you to deal rightly, justly, fairly with me. Hmm. Never loses faith. Never breaks faith.
Yeah.
Never breaks trust.
And what do you suppose Jesus really meant when he said, it is finished?
I think at least this phase of my ministry is finished. At least. Probably more, but at least that.
Yeah.
I don't think he meant that the whole plan of redemption was finished, because it's not over yet. No. Even, so.
But that's crucial, as the book of Revelation points out. At that point, Satan was revealed. Thank you, Larry and Dave, for your contribution, and my thanks also to Josiah Hakaroth, our program engineer. Next week, we are going to talk about the benefits of Christ's atoning sacrifice. Same conversation, partners. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson. Thanks to you for listening in.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.